All right, welcome back. It's time to spend some time, 2 hours, upcoming with Frank Chile and a special guest as well. We're going to talk and listen to the amazing work of William Tompkins. Bill graced this program with his presence right up until the end when it was his time to move on. And we have over 50 hours of archive interviews with Bill that are just spellbinding in many cases. They're an extraordinary story from an extraordinary man who had a life that quite clearly was not a series of coincidences. I don't believe it. I never will. He was recognized. He was selected, and that is the title of his book. He was clearly given information on a very deep and profound level and contributed his own as well. You don't just do what Bill Tompkins did as a young teenage kid. And I think many of you remember. We'll talk a little bit about that as well. But let's bring Frank back on here. Now, Frank is an extraordinary man. He is so well connected in this field and made these interviews with Bill Tompkins possible, along with our other guest who will play a big role in tonight's conversation as well. Frank, welcome back. Good to have you as always.
Thank you. Thank you. It's wonderful to be back, and it's just such a joy to be able to commemorate more of Bill's life. And May 29th would have been his birthday, and he would have been 98 years of age. It's hard to believe he's left us like 4 years ago, but what he's left us, we store studying, and it's still providing revelations. And I'm so delighted that Dr. Bob Wood is joining us tonight to give an update on Selected by Extraterrestrials Volume 2 and how it's doing. I understand he started work on Volume 3, and hopefully he'll give us an update on Mary, too.
Very good. All right. I think Bob is online now. Bob, are you there?
I am. I'm online, and I said it's a pleasure to be here.
Welcome back. Good to have you. Dr. Bob Wood is, I'd just say it, he's a genius, a scientist, a brilliant man. His life experiences are extraordinary, to put it mildly. He is rather, I guess we could call him a colleague of Bill Tompkins in many ways. Their travels went down the same pathways to a large degree. Bob Wood, by the way, was at Douglas Aircraft when my father worked there, and I always mention this because it just amazes me. Bob didn't know my dad very well, but he knew of him. My dad was the public relations director of Douglas Aircraft for 17 years, and then it became McDonnell Douglas Missiles and Space. But they were there at the same time. And I know my dad used to come home, and I'd ask him about work, and I always remembered that he just didn't want to talk a whole lot about some of the really unusual things he knew about. He was flown to the Cape for missile launches often. He knew the Germans. He was a remarkable man. But the one thing, Bob, he always said, and Frank, and I've said this before, and he was very happily married, but he'd always tell me, I was a little kid, I'd hear him say, he'd say, I can't repeat the language, but he'd say, my God, those secretaries are gorgeous. He did.
Well, your dad was somebody I revered. I was just a young kid, of course, but he was really a dominant person in the public affairs world there at
Douglas. Well, thank you.
Actually, I sort of started my career way early in the 60s when the company asked me if I would help them figure out how the UFOs worked. And that involvement resulted in my having enough of a reputation in the world that I got a phone call in 2009 from Bill Tompkins, who had heard that I was a guy who could be trusted and knew something about it. And so that's how we really met, is on the telephone. And he told me enough incredible stories that I almost wrote him off completely until he told me that he personally knew Klemperer and Elmer Wheaton, who were both my bosses at roughly the same time that I was there. And so that really caused me to go meet with this guy, Bill Tompkins, to see if he was what he said he was. And it turned out he was not only what he said he was, but he was incredibly more. And the more is what you covered in your 40 or 50 hours worth of interviews with him, Jeff. And it's just an amazing story of his life.
I don't know how we were all graced to know Bill Tompkins, but he was, I believe, the title is no exaggeration, I believe he was selected by extraterrestrials for whatever reason you want to ascribe to that, but he clearly didn't just bumble into things. It didn't happen that way. When you met him, oh, and the other thing about Bill Tompkins, he's so humble. Just the nicest man you could ever want to talk to. No arrogance, no attitude problems, nothing. And he knew so much. Go ahead, Bob.
Well, the things that, as I said, the things that impressed me was that he knew specifically, name by name, the same people I knew at the time that I was there. And it turned out we were there at the same time. Mm-hmm. And actually might have known some of the same secretaries, but I didn't take pictures of them at that time.
That's but, funny.
His involvement with the special secret program, in other words, the think tank, was particularly interesting to me because when I was there, actually in 2000 it would have been 1956 when I got out of the Army. And I was put into this area where I had to go past the guy who was running it. Presumably his name was Dr. Klemperer. But this guy Klemperer was never there. I met him once or twice, and he was always off at some other conference. And it was only after I met Bill Tompkins that I concluded that he was off running this secret program while he had this group of routine engineers, of which I was one, you know, working on the routine missiles of Nike Ajax and Nike Hercules and Nike Zoom.
Mm-hmm. The other part of this is that many people don't understand. L.A., Southern California, Douglas Aircraft, the Howard Hughes business, I don't know what you'd want to refer to it as now, Hughes Aircraft, I guess as good as any, but that and Northrop, North American, I guess Grumman was around then. These companies were all doing things that the average American would never guess, Douglas especially, and TRW, Thompson Rainbow Wooldridge. My dad used to talk about TRW. These were each of these corporations had, I think, in a compartmentalized sense, all had something to do with the ET riddle, the enigma. How do they do it? How do they fly like that? What are they up to? Where are they from? Yeah. They're all doing that. Is that correct, Bob?
That's exactly right. And furthermore, TRW is a classic example because the compartmentalization there was the basis for actually the content of Volume 2, Selected by Extraterrestrials. The listeners may not know that the first volume, Selected by Extraterrestrials, kind of took Bill's life in this secret world up to 69 or so, and then he went to TRW, and the second volume, Volume 2, talked about not only some other things that were earlier and important, but also the work you did at TRW, which was stunningly relevant to today's situation, and an in-depth understanding of the German research programs for life extension, for example, which is never mentioned in the first volume.
Yeah. Frank, you've read both volumes now. Bill
yes.
Tompkins left a garage full of data and papers that Dr. Bob Wood is heroically going through and organizing, and he has created the second book. Reading books one and books two, how do you feel about what's ahead? I mean, these are both gifts from Bill Tompkins, and we want to thank Bob. We can't thank Bob enough for doing what he's done. It's just extraordinary work editing books. Go ahead.
And Bob, the information that's in Volume 2, Bill had chatted with me about some of this information, and I'm so glad that you've been able to publish it to make it more aware to the public. But in some of our chats, they acted as triggers for Bill going on to Jeff's program and discussing some of the things, specifically like what we've chosen for tonight regarding TRW. And in your book, Volume 2, you talk about how, or Bill outlines how TRW had an influence behind the scenes in getting information into science fiction films that was not science fiction, that it was really science fact.
Yeah, that was one thing that he was really excited about, that he knew that nobody else really understood. Was that the subtle process of using the intelligence communities to tell the message through Hollywood that
yes.
that the public was supposed to be told.
Yes. Bob, I had mentioned this to Jeff. I don't know if you had gotten a chance to see it. If not, I'll send you the link for it. But the History Channel has begun another season of America's Book of Secrets. And for the new season, they've already shown this one program twice. It's called the Secret Space Program. And they outline information, but they don't attribute it to Bill. And they show some of his designs of what he had created for the off-planet program, the secret space program. But this program says that it began in 1952, but they didn't say Douglas. They said it came out of Boeing, and they said that by 1959 or 60, they had the ability of having bases on both the moon and Mars, which Bill spoke about. And it said in the early 60s that they were already transporting military personnel to outposts out there. And it said that Boeing continues to this day using a division called the Phantom Works for the secret space program. Now, I'd never heard of Boeing's Phantom Works. Had you ever heard of them before, Bob?
Yes, but only after I retired.
Okay.
I was not aware of them at the time. Actually, when I retired from McDonnell Douglas before it became Boeing.
Yes.
So that's not an exposure that I had.
But I'll send this link to you. It's interesting because it parallels what Bill shared with us in many discussions and also on radio, and yet they don't give any credit to Bill. They show some of the designs of the craft that he had created for the off-planet, the secret space program. And I'm glad that they're getting this information out there. They're not giving credit to it where it's due. But take a look at it and tell me what your thoughts are after you get a chance to view it.
Okay. Was it evident to you what the source of the information was?
They did not indicate where it came from, but they said that they had sourced this information out and that it began in 52. They had the ability to put people on Moon and Mars in 1960. And I remember asking Bill specifically about that. I told him that Bill Hamilton had told me through his own sources in Southern California that they had facilities set up on Mars in 1960, that they were sending engineers there, and they had to be single men. They couldn't be family. They could not be married because they had to be there for at least 6 months. Some of them stayed there for as much as a year. And he said the source that Bill had for this was impeccable. And when I asked Bill Tompkins about it, after Bill Hamilton had shared this with me many years ago, Bill Tompkins said, Frank, it's true. He said, we had facilities on Mars in 1960. He said, we were sending engineers out there and other people that were working on programs.
Well, I'm sure that's true. I think the question you're posing is whether or not the Boeing Phantom Spaceworks was doing something independent of what Bill and Douglas Aircraft were doing. And my guess
yes.
is the answer
they
is
may
yes.
have, they may have been. Who knows?
Yeah, but Bill was exceptionally knowledgeable about the actual evidence that we had been putting man on Mars and the Moon over the
yes.
years, starting, of course, with the Germans.
Yes.
Now, okay, starting, of course, with the Germans. See, this is a fascinating subject, to put it mildly, and for all of you out there listening saying, what's he talking about? The Germans didn't go to Mars and the Moon. They didn't have any technology like that. Neither did we. 1960 on Mars, forget it. Well, I would suggest that all of you who might think like that, read the books and listen
yes,
to the interviews.
Yes.
That's the
yes.
best I can offer you. If that's not enough for you, then that's fine. But this whole, and you'll say, a lot of you will say, what are you talking about? What about the Apollo program? What about the space shuttle? What about all these? They were a second track. That was for the public consumption. Made a lot of money for a lot of big contractors, a lot of brave people involved. But the truth of the issue was the secret space program that we had, that we obviously got a lot of tech from the Germans. They were way ahead. And this is a whole nother program we could do. But
yeah, well,
this is
my opinion is that there were multiple parallel programs to do this. One of them, of course, was the one with the Navy, where Bill was working specifically for the Navy using mm-hmm. the concepts that were involved in his think tank. But at the same time, it's also clear that the CIA and the Air Force were in possession of other craft and were hiring other companies like Northrop and Boeing to see if they could reverse engineer them. And that's what happened, is that multiple solutions for how these craft work were developed almost independently. And in my opinion, the Navy was the first one there, because Bill's own handwriting, he has a picture of a 2-kilometer spacecraft that was designed with the Douglas Aircraft concepts. So
yes.
You all heard that right, a 2-kilometer long spacecraft. Circa what year, Bob, would that be approximately?
1954 is the date on the drawing.
That's when Bill Tompkins drew the first concept of it. Okay? Now, let me just do something fun. Many people listening are probably either fond rememberers of those 1950s sci-fi movies, or younger people who have discovered them. It's a whole genre, the 1950s era of science fiction films. They didn't just happen accidentally, all right? It wasn't like Hollywood got hold of a new concept and went crazy with it. These were propaganda. These were message films. They were telling us things in the 50s, and they've been preparing us for 70 years.
Yes.
Amen.
Yep.
So this talk now about, well, disclosure is just around the corner and all that. They've been playing games. I don't need the government to tell me what I know. And what I know is what Bill Tompkins told us, and I knew before then that we were up to all kinds of advanced things in space. I just didn't have the details that we have now, thanks to Bill. And for all of you out there who are in the archives, you can listen to Bill Tompkins and just be amazed. We're going to listen tonight to some excerpts from that. But, Bob, as you look back on those 1950s science fiction movies, Invaders from Mars, War of the Worlds, The Day the Earth Stood Still, there's too many of them. They were predicated, and I'm sure the government was involved as a consultant, shall we say, if not overseer. They were preparing people, and I think it was because that they didn't know how long they were going to keep the cover-up intact. I think it went a lot longer than they expected back then. I think they were really fast-tracking people. Do you agree?
Yeah, I agree with that.
All right. Well, those were some really amazing films. They still are. They still are.
Yeah.
I wish they would play them in movie theaters on a revival basis.
In what Bill said in his volume two was the sophistication of the TRW program to deal with Hollywood in the 1970s and beyond. The movies you mentioned were earlier, and they were still part of the same process of controlling the mind of the public. I think TRW was able to take it one more sophisticated step.
Yeah, the whole period, that whole period in American history, it's just not known. And if it weren't for Bill Tompkins and you now coming along to produce Volume 2 from all of Bill's notes and things, we really now have an opportunity to look and see what was going on behind the curtain. All right, hold on just a minute. We're going to take a little break. Come right back with Dr. Bob Wood and Frank Chile, and we're going to listen to the timeless voice of William Tompkins coming up next. Okay, here we are. Now, Dr. Bob, when you were working on Volume 2 of Selected by Extraterrestrials, let me just ask you, how much material is there, and how difficult was it for you to go through and pick the pieces you want? There's so much good stuff there. There has to be. How much material is there that Bill Tompkins left?
Well, when Bill died, he basically left me his computer. And everything that he'd keystroked on his computer was what we put in Volume 1 and Volume 2. Basically, there's nothing outside of what he actually keystroked that was there. Volume 3, on the other hand, which is coming up, will be everything he said on your show, for example, and other shows, properly edited. But the answer to your question is, on Volume 1 and Volume 2, my challenge was to create something that was sort of reasonably logical and get it out. As a matter of fact, after I met Bell in 2009, it was still about 6 years before he really convinced me that we should write a book. I asked him, Bill, why do you want to write a book? He said, I want to make money. I said, nobody makes money writing UFO books, but we'll try it anyway. So we did, and we finally got it out, and I was really pressured to get something out, you know. So that's why we kind of cut it off in 1969 for Volume 1. And then the rest of what he'd written is Volume 2, and basically that was everything else that we believe that we could that was different from what he'd said, and it was relevant. There's still a few things that are left that what he said that maybe haven't been described. But I think the interesting thing to me is listening to your 40 hours or so of interview with him. He had so much more material than he ever typed up in volumes 1 and 2 that it's going to be brand new. And there are some things that he said that are still startling to me that have never been put in print. And as you know, we have taken all the transcriptions, well, we've taken all of the MP4s and made them transcriptions, so I'm looking at 40 hours worth of text that we can put in the proper sequence to the proper logic, and that's
kind of
what I'm doing right now.
Great.
And trying to harmonize and correlate that with Volume 1 and 2 and make it clear to the reader what's new.
Well, Volume 1 and 2 are basically Bill's Writing. Okay, that's understood. Frank, how many hours, I don't even remember, were there all together that that Bill and I did on the program here?
There were some 54 and a half hours, Jeff. But I'd like to make a statement and ask for an observation from Bob. Volume 2 has 69% of the reviews are five-star reviews, Bob, and some of the reviews are extraordinary. And one of the things that Bill used to ask is that, he said, I'm not the only one that was selected by the visitors to come forward with working with them. He said, I was one of 500 others. And he had always hoped that others who had been chosen to do this kind of work with the visitors would come forward and reveal their aspects of what their careers were all about. And I'm wondering, have you gotten any correspondence from any of the people who read Volume 2 or made reviews about it that offered any information behind the scenes that you felt to be really extraordinary and relevant?
That's a really interesting question. I'd say the answer is maybe no more than one person. So it's not
really
a lot of people. But on the other hand, there's some correlations that are so evident. For example, he described the 20 and back program before anybody had ever heard of Corey Good.
And that's right. You're right.
That's a dynamite statement with respect to the authenticity of that program. And the other thing he did that I think that I really need to use to convince my wife of the credibility is the fact that the details of high-speed underground tunneling systems were in place for decades. And people don't really understand that our planet is... is basically covered with a vast number of underground communication and connection facilities that are highly relevant to the history of this planet and also where we are now. So that's one of the, I think, very important things that Bill brought out that doesn't show with that much visibility, but it's really critical for people to understand that.
I agree with you.
Bob,
I'm sure he shared this with you, too. He would tell me that he had three friends who were part of the secret space program that would come to visit him in San Diego once every 20 years. They never came at the same time. They'd come at different times, and they had the opportunity to come back and live out the rest of their lives here on Earth or return and work amongst the stars. And he said they all looked to be in their early 20s because they were taking the tablet that was developed by TRW for life extension. And he said they would visit him and they would talk about things. And he said all three of them always made the decision they did not want to stay here. They'd rather go back and return and work amongst the stars.
You know, Jeff, that interview was recorded, it's going to be in book 3. So
I think it was recorded. I remember him talking about that.
Yeah,
and it's in there somewhere. That's
when we would have discussions, I would make comments to Bill, and they would act as triggers, and he'd start telling me stories of things that had been triggered, and I'd say, Bill, can you share that on Jeff's program tonight? And he said, sure, why not? Let's do it. And the ones that are going to be played tonight for the audience were based upon conversations we had the same day that he went on the air and was revealing these stories for the first time after, you know, he would tell me about them over the phone, and he would blow me away with these things.
Yeah, amazing. All right,
that's
we better get
to conversations are so exciting. Is you're never quite sure what he's going to say, and neither is he. But it's always interesting and new.
Totally
spontaneous. Yes.
Totally honest.
Totally.
Right up front. He just and no one told him to be quiet. As far as we know, he was given the green light. Go ahead and talk. So this is part of the revelation program of this whole thing. William Mills Tompkins played a key role in the first stage, I think, of the end of this asinine cover-up. So, all right, we better start and listen to some of this, or we're not going to have enough time. Bob,
yes,
can you stay with us there?
I'll stay with you, yeah.
Great. All right. Super. All right. Here we go. Frank, you want to set the first one up real quick? This is
629-16. The first one was regarding the secret space program and the work that was done behind the scenes by TRW. Bill thought this was so important. He wanted to bring this forward to the public, and this is an interesting clip.
Here we go.
I'd sort of like to get into this situation for the TRW program, where we had like limited, unlimited funds to study anything, and TRW is this, was this massive campus on Space Park, Redondo Beach, California. And it was about 12 blocks from the beach where all the girls were in their bikinis.
You would notice that, Bill.
Oh, yeah. I first things first. But the fact that the campus was one thing, and then there were several hundred off-site laboratories. And these actually contain most of the extraterrestrial side of TRW. And I think, like we've said before, Northrop Grumman bought a lot of money, and they bought TRW. So they get all this fantastic stuff that's going on and has been going on to assist them in their endeavors to go out of space. And then, secondly, Northrop buys or borrows a bunch of more money, and they buy the Newport News Shipbuilding Company in Virginia, the people that build the Navy aircraft carriers. And so then they take all of the Northrop engineers and let them climb all over three aircraft carriers under construction. And they use this information to do their design, detailed design, of their kilometer and 4 kilometer long spacecraft carriers for Solar Warden space battle groups. And I think that just addressing that in sort of a way to get into this subject, it's well established that they did build 8 separate space battle groups by 1982.
8 battle groups. And what would a battle group be composed of?
It's very similar to a surface Navy
carrier group.
Carrier group. You have one, sometimes two carriers. You have like 4 cruisers, and you have maybe 4 or 6 destroyers, backup support ships, and then a couple of submarines way ahead of the battle group. So you have the sort of the same type of surface cruisers, for instance, for the space cruisers, and then space destroyers. And incidentally enough, standard U.S. Navy attack submarines, which there's some 12, 14 U.S. Navy standard attack submarines that have the nuclear propulsion removed and electromagnetic anti-gravitational propulsion installed.
That's fascinating. They had the same same construction, right?
Yeah, and so it was the quickest way to get out there, okay? So we actually had the submarines go out before the spacecraft carriers went out.
So they would simply take the front dive and attitude wings off, and streamline them a little bit, replace the power plant. They'd have the same dual hull construction, advanced construction, and they just fly them up into space. That's very interesting.
And I think that the fact that if you stop and consider this, it's already a pressurized structure.
Of course.
It's got everything set up, so why not change the propulsion and use it as an operating submarine on the galaxy?
It's a perfect transition idea. Yeah, of course.
Real cool. And so Solar Warden itself is very ancient today, and there are 6 more, far more advanced, 4-kilometer-long spacecraft carriers, which are under construction now.
Four kilometers long. Why so big, Bill? Why? These are okay. Massive. What's the need?
Okay. A lot of people question this. They even question an aircraft carrier against what you can do with a submarine. They combined which would have been a landing assault aircraft carrier. Now, this is an aircraft carrier that doesn't look like a nuclear carrier, and it's not nuclear built.
Mm-hmm.
But it is like 800 feet long. It sets higher, has more decks, and sets higher above the water line than a regular carrier. It doesn't have the angled flight deck, but it has either helicopters or VTOL vertical takeoff and landing aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a marine ship. Of course, it's Navy, operated by the Navy, but a landing assault aircraft carrier has a tremendous size inside hangar, which then what they do when they get to the area that they were going to have in the battle, they go towards the coast, they flood the rear end of the aft end of the ship, water comes in, and they have all these landing assault boats with personnel and tanks in the boats.
Right.
The doors open the back, and they just float right out, and they go back to shore and drop off the personnel and the tanks and go back and get some more.
Right.
So a landing assault spaceship then is designed into what would have been just a space craft carrier.
So all right, now, but Bill, excuse me, wouldn't that require a complete, they might as well build it from scratch. They've got to double hull everything. They've got to make it habitable for crew. They have to have airlocks. They have to have all kinds of technology. I mean, they can't just take a landing assault carrier, put a new power plant, and fly it up into space. They wouldn't have, they're not airtight.
No, you're absolutely correct, and we're not saying that. What we're saying is that the class of surface ship Navy assault carriers design is then used in the larger spacecraft carrier, which finds that mission. So you actually don't take a landing assault and then redesign it in space.
Right.
You start from scratch and design a new spacecraft.
So it's a member of the strategic tactical fleet, so to speak, that they're using in space. It's one of the primary capital ships, spaceships in space.
And sort of an easy way to address this. For instance, if we have the Nordic Navy spacecraft carrier groups, they might have 20 of the complete battle groups, okay? But the problem here is that, and the numbers are not for certain, but the problems are in percent pretty close. The Draco reptilian type space battle groups, instead of being 20, are 200. In other words, the Nordics would have 20 of them. The Dracos would have 200. So this is a disadvantage for the Nordic Navy.
Now, are we to assume, Bill, pardon me again, are we to assume that this much firepower is or was lurking around this planet in orbit, or did it come down to the ground level at any time? That's a lot of stuff.
Okay. They definitely do not come back down into the ground in most cases. Yes, they have very large cruiser-type space ships, which can come in the atmosphere, and they are streamlined in shape.
Mm-hmm.
But it's in space, and as long as it's operating in space, it can be a triangle shape.
Or a square, or a circle, or look like an automobile wreck. It can look any way it wants.
Yeah. It can have all kinds of garbage hanging out the side of it.
Right. Well, when you see these pictures tonight, some of them are suggestive of that. So they're just extraordinary. I'll look forward to getting your response, too, on that. Okay. So we have reptilians with 200 battle groups. We have the Nordics with 20 battle groups. Are these two opposing intelligent life forms at war, or are they giving each other some kind of mutual standoff status? What was the situation between them?
Okay. At one time, we understand that the Nordics did take out, years ago, a group of Draco-type navies and removed them from that area that the Nordic stars and planets are in. However, that was a long time ago.
Yeah.
So there are both skirmishes and wars existing now, if the information that we have is correct.
All right. Now, when you say 200, when you say one more thing, please. When you say 200 battle groups, we're talking about spread out all over the certainly the galaxy, right? And not here.
Yes, you're not talking. You're not talking about those ships even parked out in.
I got you. I just want to be sure people understand. This is the big picture we're talking about. All right.
Very big, and but unfortunately, this is what we have to deal with, and so. It's also understood that the Draco reptilian group have owned this planet for thousands of years. Now, they let and they allow other civilizations to come into the planet and operate their own agenda requirements. So you may have as many as 50 other extraterrestrial civilization people who are here implementing their programs.
I see.
So what this then appears to be is that this planet Earth is simply a large laboratory and being used by many, many different people for all kinds of different agendas.
All right, let me stop it right there and just get a couple comments from Frank and Dr. Bob Wood on what was said so far. We're trying to paint a picture so people understood that this was spread out all over the galaxy. This is a big galaxy, the Milky Way. Bob, what are your thoughts on what you just heard there? That we could take a submarine, double hull, already pressurized, outfitted with a new drive system, and essentially take it up into space. That was a quick fix rather than build everything from scratch. That's what Bill said.
Well, that concept was so straightforward and simple that I was sure that it was exactly right when Bill told me the details of how they did it. I think the other aspect of what we're talking about is the huge numbers of craft and whether they're localized in our solar system or in the galaxy. This is another thing that I grasped from Bill as I got to know him better, is that he kept talking about the galaxy. And I used to think that maybe he was just exaggerating, that he was just talking about the two or three closest star systems. But I've concluded, especially in reading some of the recent work of Michael Saha, that he was right on, and that he's talking about the entire galaxy, that the ability for these crafts to go from one place to another is just incredibly beyond what most people have contemplated.
Frank, final comment before we have to break here.
I'm in complete accord with what Dr. Bob Wood just said, and in part two that you're going to be playing tonight, Bill talks about the space cadets that the Star Visitors trained outside of Medford, Oregon, and they took them out into the galaxy, and Bill accompanied them, and he talks about that. It's an incredible, incredible tale.
Funny, amazing. Because Medford is the area I am in.
Yes, yeah.
Okay. Quick question for Dr. Bob. I had a talk with someone the other day who said that a friend is able to see people as they really are. And the friend said that they went into a place to eat, a restaurant, and sat down, and the person with the ability said, there are 14 ETs in this restaurant, and I need to move to another area, or they're going to figure out that I know that they're here. Does that surprise you?
Well, having as many as 14 one time surprises me a little bit, but the idea that the ETs can pass and do all the time does not surprise me at all. And that the concept of shape-shifting that Bill often talked about, but never in much detail, is something I've always tried to understand as to whether the ETs are actually... really look like reptilians, but shift their shape so they look like Homo sapiens or not. I really don't know the answer to that question, and I don't know whether Bill did or not.
Right. It may be that they are putting in our minds what they want us to see them appearing as another
exactly.
human. I mean, that's doable. So anyhow, the point is...
Bob, a quick question? Do we have time for a quick question?
Real quick. Go ahead.
Okay. Bob, Bill told me that one of his friends went down to Mexico and took some photographs of folks along the beach. And when he viewed them, he said he could see that there were visitors walking amongst the humans that were visiting the beach. And he said the humans on the beach did not see the visitors that were there, but they showed up in the photos that were taken by Bill's friend. Did you ever see those photos?
I did not see those photos, and it's a very interesting story. Thank you.
Yes. Yeah. I think it's fairly safe to say that we are always visited, and there are visitors always among us. I think that's reasonable. Okay. Hold on, everyone. We'll be right back. More of the amazing Bill Tompkins.